Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. By any chance, are you hungry? Well, if you're not, you're going to be, because my guest today is Danielle Saunders. That's Chef Danielle Saunders, who, in 2011, wowed the judges on the Food Network, winding up the winner of its hit show, Chopped, the first female African-American to do so. She was then invited to compete in Chopped Champions. She nailed it, and again became the first female African-American to do so in the show's history. Danielle's love of cooking began at the tender age of 5, when she started helping her family prepare Sunday dinner. When it came time for college, though, she didn't initially pursue a culinary career, majoring instead in pharmaceutical chemistry at Norfolk State. But after 2 years, she decided to can chemistry and enrolled at the New York Restaurant School. After graduation, Danielle worked under some very renowned chefs, including Michael LaMonaco at Manhattan's Windows on the World, where she stayed until 2 weeks before 9/11. Then she went on to become executive chef at Panavino Restaurant at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center for 3.5 years. In 2002, Danielle started her own business. It's a family affair. Several years later, she became P. Diddy's personal chef, traveling all over the world. As her reputation grew, so did her client list. Danielle has fed Oprah, Mary J. Blige, Tom Hanks, and former New York Mets and Yankee outfielder Gary Sheffield, to name a few. Danielle, who's had extensive training in farm-to-table, raw, organic, and plant-based cuisine, is currently working on her first cookbook, based on the original recipes of her grandfather, who Danielle says was an amazing chef. Danielle, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So growing up, Danielle, what was Sunday dinner like at the Saunders household?
Oh, my goodness. A plethora of food, shall I say. Lessons, stories, family is what I would call our Sunday dinners, and that's what they are to this day. My mom has kept that tradition going, so we have anywhere from 6 to 20 people at our dinner table on any given Sunday.
Now, does the menu change every week?
Well, we have our staples.
Standard.
Yeah, our standard staples that we do every Sunday. They're just traditional, and so we keep those going. But I've elevated them all by changing some of the ingredients to make them more appealing and healthier to everyone that's enjoying them. So we do switch it up, though. We switch it up. We don't eat a lot of red meat, so we are innovative when it comes to our menu planning based on the people that we're going to be serving that day. So we try to switch it up so it's interesting to everyone all the time.
So give me a full-fledged menu, but throw some dishes at me.
Okay, so a long braised beef short rib with drunken carrots and pan gravy could be one item. Collard greens with smoked turkey confit, which is a staple. That's something that we'd have. You need your green vegetables, so that's something that we'd have. An elevation to that would be adding kale, because kale is like the new green that everyone that everyone's eating, but
that's
it's something that we've consumed.
So you want to be so au courant.
Oh, yes. We've got to stay current with what's happening. So, you know, we'll add some kale to our collard greens, but those are staples. Cornbread, skillet cornbread is a staple, something that we always have in our home for Sunday dinner. Smothered turkey wings is a favorite,
Of
my
sounds
mother's.
Divine.
And so it's an alternative to frying. So if you roast them really long, you can have them with or without gravy. So it's just those different ways of preparing and different techniques. But those are staples that we would always have.
Now, obviously, it was fun for you to be in the kitchen at 5 and you were included in this activity, which is a welcoming and fun thing to do.
Yes.
But that's very different than feeling that you have a calling to be in the kitchen. So let me ask you, did you know that about yourself? Did you know you had a calling?
It was just the love and the joy of doing something that was fun for me and being around someone that I loved. I idolized my Nana and my grandma, and so I only had 6 short years with her, but my memories of her are very fond, and most of those memories were surrounded by cooking and her teaching me things. And as I've stated in bios and in other things that have been written about me, she had a 4th grade education, which I am not ashamed to talk about, because she was one of the wisest people that I'd ever met. And when I say wise, I mean with life lessons and things that she taught me and again, again, my memory of spending time with her. So cooking was just one of the fun things that she allowed me to do and express myself fully with no bars held. You know, she just let me be free. And one of the stories that I always tell is her teaching me to take the ribs out of the collard greens because they were tough and harder to cook, and piling the leaves up and rolling them. And I would have a butter knife and she would have, you know, a sharp blade knife, yeah. Right? But uh-huh. I would have a butter knife because I would think I was getting busy and going to town along with her. And I remember her telling me to cut them in strips and so that they would cook evenly. And going to culinary school 20 years later to find that there was a technical French term called chiffonade for what she had taught me. She knew nothing of what chiffonade was, but for me, that was one of the many defining moments that let me know that I had chosen the correct career and that I was on the right path and onto something.
Well, let's talk about pharmaceutical chemistry. I mean, come on. Nothing against pharmaceutical chemists.
Nothing against it. You know, I think when you are raised by workers and baby boomers, it's just the path that you're supposed to take. And so that's what we had discussed. That was what was of interest in my home when it was time for me to go to college. And so that was my path, and that's what I was going to do. And getting into it, I guess I had no clue as to what I was getting myself into. Being good in science and not being good in math didn't add up, you know what I mean? Right. When I got to Norfolk State and got to that junction of my life. So cooking has always been a very important part. And I just remember taking the money that my parents had given me to buy food and take care of myself at college. And I took that to buy more food and multiply that and started cooking and selling it, I guess, is really when I knew that pharmaceutical chemistry definitely was not my calling.
Unless you were making drugs for people.
Exactly. Unless I was making some, you know, making drugs, which I wasn't doing because I wasn't paying attention in chemistry class. So therefore, cooking was definitely my calling, and it was something that was in my heart, but I guess I just didn't know how to explain that to my parents after wasting, you know, several thousand dollars on college and just not knowing the direction I wanted to go in. So
applying to a culinary school seemed to make the most sense to you.
Absolutely. It made mm-hmm. the most sense. And again, I knew that I didn't want to go back to school that summer when my dad picked me up, but didn't know how to verbalize that to them after wasting so much time and money. But I was able to do so, and I ended up working at Nordstrom's in the ladies' shoe department for 6 or 7 months, saving money, because my parents were like, well, you know what? Being that you've done this, you have somewhere to stay, but you're on your own mm-hmm. as far as, you know, school is concerned. You've wasted your allotment. We have another kid that needs to go to college. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to kind of figure it out. And with their support fully, I was able to do that. And so working at Nordstrom's in a ladies' shoe department helped me get my funds together, and it gave me a leg to stand on. And
No pun intended.
And I applied to New York Restaurant School, got in. And I want to say within 3 months from coming home from Norfolk State, I was in culinary school because that was my goal.
So once you got there, talk about lady shoes. Did it feel like you just slipped into a really comfortable shoe, that this is, you knew at that point that this is where I belong?
Being an African-American female in a very Caucasian male-dominated profession, again, I had stepped into a world that I had no clue.
Fish out of water?
Fish out of water, I would say. But the intrigue, the anxiety, the love, everything that came, the passion from working in restaurants and just seeing how it operated and seeing all the components, back of the house, front of the house, just being intrigued from all of the different directions that food could take me, that's when I knew that it was where I needed to be. So I just needed to find my niche and find, you know, where I would be best at. And in most restaurants, you start, you know, from the bottom. You start prepping. You start in garde manger, you know, making salads and things like that. And you work your way up through the ranks. And most times when you're in culinary school, they tell you, you know, look to the left of you, look to the right of you. 9 times out of 10, the person sitting beside you will not be in this industry, just because people get into it and really don't know what they're getting themselves into. And then it becomes, either you get burnt out really fast or you realize it isn't for you and you just you know, stop.
So there was a mutual admiration society, in a sense, at New York Restaurant School. They recognized the talent in you, and you knew that this is where you should be.
Absolutely. My main instructor, Mr. Neil Becker, was very instrumental in letting me know that he saw something in me. So at that point, I knew that when a teacher or an instructor was hard on you, it was because they saw a gift in you. And so I kind of took that and ran with it. And I owe a lot to him. I know that he may not know that because I haven't seen him in over 20 years, but he was very instrumental in my confidence in who I was going to become.
So you graduate. The program's how long?
19 months.
19 months.
Yes.
And you wind up at Windows on the World.
Well, first, before I even got to Windows on the World, I did my internship at the Lobster Club under the tutelage of Ann Rosenzweig, pioneering female chef in the industry.
In Manhattan?
In Manhattan, yes. And so I worked for her during my internship. And from there, I went on to Michael's on the Upper West Side of 55th, between 5th and 6th, and worked there under the tutelage of great chefs and restaurant owners. And so it was the beginning of me finding myself and finding where I actually belonged in this industry.
And then you made it downtown. That was a seminal move. I mean, Windows on the World, it was not a diner.
No, it was an amazing monstrosity of a restaurant. I mean, there was not only Windows, but there was The Greatest Bar on Earth, which was a huge attraction. There was Wild Blue, which was a smaller 60-seat bistro, which was Michael LaMonaco's baby.
In the same building.
All in the same building.
At
all
World
in
Trade
the same
Center.
Affiliate. Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. But I had the opportunity to work in Wild Blue, and it was an amazing experience because of the people that we would serve and the prestige that came along with working at Windows on the World.
But what were your jobs there? Were you a sous chef?
Well, no, I was a roundsman. So a roundsman, I was promoted from garde manger to roundsman. So when I started there, I was working in salads, making stocks, you know, from the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And when I left, I was a roundsman at Wild Blue. And a roundsman is a person that can work every single station on the line. So your entremetier, which is the person that's in the middle who makes the vegetables, who kind of finishes the plates. Then there's the person who's on the grill. Then there's a saucier. Then there's poissonnier cookery, someone who does all the fish. So I kind of worked my way up the ranks and was able to work all of those stations at Wild Blue before I decided to leave approximately 2 weeks before 9/11, which was crazy situation because people were so disappointed, I want to say, as to why I would leave such a prestigious place. But I knew that there was no more growth there for me.
Mm-hmm.
And other opportunities had come along, which I felt would catapult me to the next junction in my career.
You knew it was time to go.
Yeah, it was just time for me to leave. And again, without knowing what was to come, thankfully, I was able to leave and move on and work at a place called the Momentum AIDS Project, which is a nonprofit organization that was originally put together by a lot of chefs that originally opened the 21 Club. So a nonprofit organization feeding people in all five boroughs with AIDS and HIV, but fine dining food.
Wow.
So it was an amazing time for me to do some philanthropic work and kind of give back. And that's just where my head was at that time. I wanted to give back. I wanted to not be in the foo-foo shishi part of, you know, food service. I wanted to be in the nitty-gritty of it. And one of the sous chefs that worked at Windows on the World by the name of Sean Thorne had left to go and do this and offered me a job. And I took it and ran with it and did that for about a year and a half before I ended up at Lincoln Center.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Chef Danielle Saunders. So you kind of make your way around Manhattan. Then you start your own company.
Yes.
It's a family affair. Then you wind up working for some big, bold face names, as I mentioned in the introduction.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Even before, I've had some amazing people that have come my way. When I first started Family Affair, one of my first parties out the gate was for a woman by the name of Toni Faye, who was a big exec at, or vice president, I'm sorry, at Time Warner Group. My first party was for Maya Angelou. And
we know her.
I'm sure we all know her. That was my first event. And so,
where you were calling the shots and running the show?
I was calling the shots and running the show at this event, hyperventilating all at the same time, you know, trying to get it done because I knew who I was in the presence of. So that would be the first party. I mean, the second party after that, I did the opening gala for the Faison Firehouse in Harlem for George Faison, who I believe was the first African-American to win a Tony Award. He's a huge choreographer. I believe he did the score for The Wiz. Vivian Hewitt, who was the owner and seller of one of the finest African-American art collections in the country. So before I even got to the other big names, I had already worked for and done events for amazing folks like the people that I just mentioned.
How did you sort of pull off the fact that you were a one-man band, in a sense, after having always worked for somebody else?
Well, that was the birth of Family Affair. And I mean, my company's name, it's true to its name. So my mother, my father, my aunt, cousins, my little brother, everyone kind of partakes in making this come to fruition. So one-man band, as far as being the front and face of a company without proper PR or management, that is what we are. But we're a family, and the foundation that we have is so strong, everyone just kind of jumps in and pulls their weight and does their part and makes it happen.
Are you known for one particular style of cuisine, or are you very eclectic?
I would say I'm very eclectic because of the wide base of my client. Mm-hmm. I have clients
from— I mean, what are you known for? Do you have certain specialties?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, people try to put a name on you, and so they name me the soul food chef, or soul fusion is the style of cooking that I go by. And the fusion portion of it is because of the eclectic base of clients that I have and the different kinds of work that I do. So I'm also certified by Dr. Oz Garcia, who's a world-renowned nutritionist and life extension specialist here in the city. And so with him, I've learned a lot of wheat-free, gluten-free, raw, farm-to-table, more so like spa-type cooking, which is more geared towards people that want to lose weight or maintain weight.
So a
more healthier lifestyle. So I'm kind of well-versed in a lot of different areas. I mean, I've had Jewish clients, so I can do a Seder dinner or a Passover. It just depends what, you know, the client is calling for. I've tried to make my repertoire as round as I possibly could to service as many different people.
So what's it like to work for P. Diddy and some of these other boldface names?
Working for all of these different types of people and people from different walks of life only help to build character and make you who you are. So with P. Diddy, it was a whirlwind because it was my first personal chefing job. So I was very, very wet behind the ears, didn't know what I was getting myself into, but wouldn't take one experience back because it molded and shaped me into the chef that I am now. It made me relentless. It made me very tough-skinned with things that I would probably, you know, shy away from. It gave me confidence. So working for people like him, his work ethic is completely unmatched. I've never seen anyone work as hard as he does. And when you work for people like that, they push you.
So he was demanding?
Very, very, very much so, but in a good way, in a way that I would push myself and push my own limitations. So doing one of his New Year's Eve parties was probably one of the pinnacle moments in my career, because you have everybody that who is someone attending his, you know, event, and food is usually the nucleus of any party or any event. So for me, being able to pull that off was just another notch on my belt, so to say. Again, I attribute all of those things to him because he has a hell of a work ethic and is an amazing businessman. And those are the things that you pull away from people like P. Diddy's and the Mary J. Blige's. You pull away the things that can help you grow and make you who you are.
He flew you all over the place, didn't he?
Absolutely.
Was it lonely or was it overwhelming?
I would probably say a little bit of both. Overwhelming in the sense of your family isn't there. You're kind of on your own. You're in these countries where you know no one. So you are a lot of times self-reliant. Mm-hmm. There are language barriers. You still need to get your job done. You're looking for eggs. You know what I mean? Whatever it is, you're looking for all of this stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, the client doesn't want to hear, oh, I couldn't speak the language, so I couldn't get you needed. I'm paying you this amount of money, so you've got to make it happen. So I guess it made me more, I relied on myself more and I had to do a lot more research. So in order to get the things that I needed when we were in foreign places. So for me, again, it was just a growing experience and for me to become a better chef, become a better person, learn more about myself.
Anyone you didn't like working for who was famous?
I wouldn't say didn't like. I mean, we all have our bad days.
Of course.
And so you have to take that into consideration. And for me, you may have a little bit more money than me. But again, the way that I was taught and raised, we all put our pants on the same way. We're all human
beings.
One
leg at a time.
We all, you know, bleed red blood. So at the end of the day, I've never been in a situation where I was starstruck or dumbfounded by the person that I was working for.
Only, or abused.
Or well, that comes with the territory, but I think that when you put your foot down and you present yourself as a strong person and someone who really can't be rattled that easily, I think that people kind of take the long route to mess with you in that respect. And so I've been blessed to for that to be my stand in the industry, and meaning a strong woman. And I really haven't had too much abuse.
When you are someone's personal chef, are you on call 3 meals a day?
It depends on who the person is. It depends on who it is. But most times you're on call and you just kind of have to make it happen.
Even if you're making a BLT.
Even if you're making a BLT. I mean, I remember working for P. Diddy. I would say on any given weekday, if we were in Miami, he'd have dinner parties or, you know, have a party at the house where people would come back from a club. It could be 3 in the morning.
And you're in the
kitchen.
They'd
intercom me and say, chef, we need you to the kitchen. And I'd come down and they'd say, okay, well, in an hour, he'll be here with, you know, 40 people and we're just going to party
Just
listen to some music or whatever. And literally, I'd have to make it happen.
Speaking of making it happen, let's shift gears and talk about the Food Network.
Okay.
How did that get off the ground?
A friend of mine actually called me and said, the Food Network is casting for their anchor show, and I think you'd be awesome. We're going to cast. We're going to actually fill out applications and see who casts, and I think you should do it. And a friend of mine emailed me the casting application. I filled it out, and I want to say maybe 3 weeks later, I got a call from
This is in 2010?
This is in 2010, when everything originally happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a call saying that production wanted to speak with me, and I don't even think it was a long telephone interview. I think they gave me a brief telephone interview, and then they set up a test run.
Uh-huh.
And they do it whether if you're working in a restaurant or you do it at your home, whatever it is. So I ended up doing it at my home because whatever story I sent, family was my background and family was my foundation for everything. So I think it was a Sunday dinner story that I shared. And so they ended up coming to my home, my family's home, and they did my test run there. And a few weeks after that, I learned that I had cast for the show.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Chef Danielle Saunders. And so that must have been huge, A, and B, nerve-wracking.
It was nerve-wracking in the sense because I had been on television once before. I had done, P. Diddy had done a series of television shows on VH1 called Who Wants to Work for Diddy, where he did this nationwide search looking for assistants and people that wanted to work for him. So one of the challenges on this show was the assistants needed to get together and collectively make his family a dinner on a yacht in New York City. So they called me in as the food specialist because I know him so well. And I was able to kind of guide these guys and how to, you know, make this meal for P. Diddy and his family. So that was my first television experience. So I think the nerve wracking came from being on television and, you know, someone like honing in and watching you. But for me, when I'm cooking is when I'm most at ease.
And so you're in another place.
I'm in another world, like not even
aware
everything else is oblivious to me when I'm cooking.
So what did you have to make for that Chopped episode?
It was an amazing experience, to say the least. You meet so many amazing people from different walks of life. Like, everyone's there for their reason. And at the time, I was consulting on restaurants and opening restaurants for other people. So it was stressful for me in that manner because I took all of that stress to the studio with me. But kind of like melted away when you're actually in the actions of cooking. But in my first basket, I want to say I got elk. I got a vegetable. But the night before, it's so funny, the night before I had done a practice run with my family. My dad had gone to Fairway.
And brought home elk?
He didn't bring home elk. He brought boar.
Oh, is that hilarious?
He brought boar. And he bought me quail eggs. And my dad had an eclectic mix of things. And so we had 3 judges at home. We were timed. My dad
you
was
go,
actually
girl.
Ted Allen. Like, so it was really, really, it was interesting. It was fun. And what the crazy thing is, before going on the show, I had never watched it. had never watched the show. So I only understood the premise, but didn't know what I was getting myself into. I know food and my love of food. And so that's what I was going with. That's what I brought with me. But I also got a vegetable called jus mallow, which is an African vegetable. It's leafy and green like spinach, but it has the slime factor of okra. And then they gave
it
to
me.
So yeah, tell me. So, and they gave it to me in the frozen form.
I hear that goes
form.
Very well with elk.
I so do I. All you need is some mashed potatoes and you'll be fine and you have a cohesive meal. So yeah, I got some in the first basket I opened literally had never worked with any of the ingredients in the basket. So I just treated them like things that I knew and worked with them as if it were a steak and spinach, and that's exactly what I did. And so for me it's just the common comparison of food. I mean, we're a lot closer than we think we are. You know what I mean? As far as ethnicity is concerned and food and culture. So that's what I did. And that's what I do with a lot of things that I feel confused with. You treat them like things.
And then how much after that was Chop Champions?
I want to say 7 months.
Oh, okay.
You know, because it was at the end of 1 year, but going into the beginning of the next
year. Was that
year.
More stressful?
That was very, very stressful. Literally, when production called me, the talent coordinator, who is now a good friend of mine, says to me when she called, I said, no, I don't want to do it. No, I don't want it. It was too nerve-wracking. I don't need it. I don't want to do it. And she like said to me on the phone, like, you're going to do this. You won the first time. There's no way. Like, and she was my inspiration for coming back. And so I agreed to come back and again had to do two television performances back to back in order to, because you have to compete for one of the final four spots. And I was there with some heavy hitters and I just kind of wasn't intimidated, but just wasn't in the headspace of competing. And so my confidence wasn't where it should have been. But before I went in, I said my prayers as I always do and literally just kind of went head first, knocked everyone out. And before you knew it, I was standing there alone.
Isn't
and my family
crazy?
Was coming out to greet me. And it was the crazy thing is because I hadn't seen them. All I remember is my parents saying to me, the young lady, Joelle, who was the talent coordinator, say, well, if she wins, you guys go through this door. And if she loses, you guys are going to go through this door. And I only remember my mom saying when she said go through this door, which was the winning door. And they literally walk on stage to greet you. And that was the next thing I know. I saw my family coming out
and
to
greet me.
And that's
how you knew you won?
And that's how I knew that I won. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. Like, just in total shock and awe. It was nothing but the grace of God that
Well,
that
and
that
talent.
Well, and
come
talent.
On.
No, but who's to say? Everyone can have, I mean, the best chef can go up. Michelin star chef can go up and just have a bad day. It
sure.
just depends on the day and what you're doing and the energy that you're exuding. So it was my day, apparently.
We're running out of time, and this went so fast. But what's in your future?
Well, right now I'm in the process of continuing to brand myself. I've launched the Chef Coat line in collaboration with a boutique in Brooklyn called Leisure Life. A very good friend of mine who is a designer. And so right now we have 7 samples of Chef Coats that I am literally wearing everywhere. So I've worn one on the Today Show. I've worn one on Dr. Oz.
Would I wear one?
Of course you would.
Even though I don't.
You don't have to be a chef to wear one. You just feel very empowered and
okay.
You need one. I'm going to make sure you get one. And so we've done several different styles. I would like to consider myself a fashionista. So it was my way of bringing fashion into the kitchen along with uniforms not having ladies in mind. You
yeah.
know what I mean? They're not cut for us. Again, it's a male-dominated profession. So there are things that the coats didn't have that I wanted them to have. Like, for instance, your bra strap slides down when you're cooking and moving a lot. So I wanted to have little tabs where you could lock the bra strap in. Just small things that made it feel more feminine, that made it feel more ladylike.
User-friendly.
User-friendly, for sure. And just made me feel a part of what I was cooking for. So that was the reasoning and the life behind the Chef Coats, and I can't wait to share that with everyone.
And you're working on a cookbook?
I think at this point we're going to go the self-publishing route. I've been playing around with that a lot. I really want to be able to incorporate my grandfather's story and the things that I've learned and my love of cooking from a child into that book. So just continuing to work on it. It's taken a lot longer than I thought, but I want it to be amazing.
Well, Danielle, keep cooking.
I am.
Sunday meals notwithstanding.
And you're invited. You know that, right?
Oh, man, I'll be knocking on your
okay,
door.
Good.
Absolutely.
Good.
It was so fast because it was so interesting. You've got so much to say. This was so my pleasure to get to know you.
Good. My pleasure getting to know you as well. I thank you for sharing this opportunity with me.
I really do. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have any guests or ideas, suggestions for the show, visit our website at sandyclineshow.com. Nobody but I-